Hey guys, it's Albert. We got a fantastic show coming for you this week. In the takeaways, we're going to cover the free agent quarterbacks and the movers and shakers in the NFL draft. We got a special guest coming on. Can't wait for this one to discuss Tom Brady. A guy who knows Tom Brady very, very well is coming in. And as always, we'll wrap things up with all of your questions in the mailbag. Let's go. All right, welcome in. It's the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. As you can tell by the sound of my voice, I had just got back from Indianapolis. The combine's in the books. We're still about 2 weeks out from the beginning of free agency, of course, the draft after that. And we are bursting with information now, having just come back from, you know, what I think is the rough equivalent of a trade show from NFL, from an NFL standpoint. Every coach, or most of the coaches now, not all of them, the scouts, a lot of top executives were in Indianapolis together for a week, which means there's lots of conversations, there's lots of negotiating, there's lots of back and forth to set up the rest of the offseason. And so before we get to a great guest who's going to help us break down the Tom Brady situation, we're going to help you set you up for the offseason and what's ahead, first in free agency and then in the draft. And the first takeaway, of course, has to be on Tom Brady. He has sucked the oxygen out of the rest of the NFL. He sucked the oxygen out of Combine Week. Much of Combine Week became about Tom Brady and where he will wind up going on March 18th. I am where I was at the end of the season, which is my thought on him going back to New England is based on the idea that his best option will be to go back there and the Patriots' best option will be to have him back there. Now, there's a little bit of a dance going on. The two sides have to meet. That's an important part. And I'm not talking about their agents or intermediaries or any of that. Tom Brady and Bill Belichick need to sit down and talk because Brady's willing to go back under certain terms. Belichick's willing to have him back under certain terms. They need to figure out whether or not those terms mesh with one another. Now, as for why we are where we are, I'm going to give you guys a few things, broke some of this down in the Monday column too, to kind of explain to you why the meeting hasn't happened, why there's so much uncertainty still, and give you guys kind of a primer for why we are where we are. Number one, the CBA is a factor. There's no question about that. The lawyers from the NFL and NFLPA are working this week on language. There will be a 300-page document that will go out to all the players at some point in the next week or so. Then players will vote. Once we know whether we're operating under a new CBA or the 2011 CBA, you'll have more certainty as to how you're going forward from a team standpoint. Now, why is this important to Belichick? Why couldn't he talk around this? I don't think Belichick wants to have a string of meetings. I don't think the Patriots want to have a string of meetings. I don't think they want to go in there and say, well, you know, if A happens, then we'll do this. If B happens, then we'll do that. I don't think Belichick's interested in that. I think he would rather have one meeting where they sort of cover everything and everybody's able to put their cards on the table. And with the CBA still being sort of in the ether, it's hard to make any sort of definitive statement on where you are from a financial standpoint, what you'll be able to do with free agents. It's also harder for the team, I think, to look and ascertain its options at quarterback if Brady isn't there. And so I think it is a factor. It's not a driving factor, but it is a factor in why we are where we are. The last negotiation is a factor too. And I think that this is what makes it a little bit more difficult for the Patriots to convince Brady to come back. When Brady decided to do the adjustment to his contract last summer and take the $8 million raise, the biggest problem he had with the way that it went wasn't the Patriots' lack of willingness to go somewhere from a raw dollar standpoint. It was the lack of guaranteeing years. And I think, you know, and my understanding of it was that Brady wanted years. Brady would have liked to do maybe a 2-year extension. So at least then he could put an end date on his career. He'd know he was a starting quarterback going forward. The Patriots wouldn't do that for him. And so he took on an added 17 games, 16 plus the one playoff game of injury risk. When a player takes on injury risk, added injury risk, they become inherently less willing to take a team discount. Because when a team does a deal a year early, 2 years early, they're buying back that injury risk, right? So they're going to want some sort of payback for taking the injury risk on and off the shoulders of the player. In this case, Brady took on all the injury risks, so that makes it a little bit more complicated. I'm told the Crafts will not involve themselves here unless they're called upon. That makes sense to me too. And what I, the reasoning I was given was very, very logical. Okay, I think Robert Kraft realizes that if he intervenes, and if he kind of parachutes in and says, "No, I'm not standing for this. I want Tom Brady to retire a Patriot," it will poison his relationship with Belichick. It will poison the relationship between Belichick and Brady. It will make for an uncomfortable, at the very least, working situation going forward with everybody, with the most important people in that building. And so he's not going to do that. Now, if they need to be creative from a cap standpoint, if they need, you know, financial concessions, all of that, he'll be there for that. But he's not going to intervene and come and save the day and make sure that Brady remains a Patriot. I fully believe and have been told that Belichick's decision on that will be final. Brady's market's good, not great. I'll take you through the teams. The Giants won't be involved. The Colts won't be involved. The Raiders, the Chargers, the Titans, the Bucks will all investigate it. So that's four teams right there. And it's going to be interesting to see the way this plays out because those places aren't perfect. I mean, it's going to be very, very hard to recreate what he has in New England. We're going to talk to our guest about that. Very, very difficult to recreate what he has in New England. And so I think each of those teams will throw their hat in the ring. But this is a good, not great market for a free agent quarterback at 43 years old. Given that his age, it's an incredible market because nobody makes it to that age. But for a free agent quarterback in general, it's a good, not great market. Okay, takeaway number two. The rest of the quarterback market is basically on hold right now because of the Tom Brady situation. That means Phillip Rivers, Ryan Tannehill, Marcus Mariota, Jameis Winston, Teddy Bridgewater, all of these guys that are floating around out there, even like an Andy Dalton who's on a team but probably getting traded. All of these guys are sort of waiting for that domino to fall. And to me, Tannehill is the most interesting one of that group because Tannehill is unsigned for 2020. He led the Titans to the AFC title game last year. They're going to have to make a decision on whether or not to tag him by March 12th. And if they don't tag him, they really expose themselves. Because then if they don't get Brady in the interim, while they wait to see what Brady is going to do, they could lose Tannehill. Someone like the Raiders could come after Tannehill. And so it'd be a real dice roll. And I think that the Titans are amenable to bringing Tannehill back. And maybe John Robinson and Mike Vrabel look at it and say to themselves, we're better off going with the sure thing. If we know we can get Tannehill done before March 12th, or if we know that we're good with Tannehill by tagging him, maybe the certainty of that is a better bet for them than going forward with than going forward and rolling the dice on landing Tom Brady, which would take another suitor off the market for Brady, of course. Phillip Rivers, the Indianapolis connection's been made. Obviously, you know, there's a lot of personal connections for him there. Guys he worked with in San Diego, in the head coach, Frank Reich, and the offensive coordinator, Nick Sirianni. I think Rivers would like to. I think that's one of the places Rivers would like to be. I think if you asked him, the two places, you know, that are most appealing to him are Tennessee, which I don't think will be available to him, and Indianapolis. The question is, do the Colts like him back as much? And so he would sort of be, I think, an ideal bridge quarterback there, where you have him for maybe 2 years, and that buys you time to find the next guy. He's very familiar, of course, with everything there. Marcus Mariota is another one that's sort of interesting to me. I think he'd be in play for the Patriots if they lost Brady. He also has connections in Indianapolis. Their tight ends coach, Jason Michael, is very, very close with Marcus Mariota. So if they wanted to go with a little bit of a cheaper option, the Colts could look at Marcus Mariota. Jameis Winston, I think I would not slam the door shut on him going back to Tampa. But I look at Jameis and see a guy who could use being in the situation Ryan Tannehill was in last year, where sort of had to go and earn his way back up the depth chart. And that's why, like, the Raiders, like Las Vegas, makes some sense to me on Winston. Teddy Bridgewater is an interesting one. I think he's sort of a wild card and maybe more beholden to the rest of the market than anyone else. Tampa's been mentioned. It'd be interesting to see him play in Tampa's system just because the way it's set up. He's not really like a big arm downfield thrower with a big body, which is what Bruce Arians has always favored, because he wants quarterbacks who can stand in there, who can take hits, and who can get the ball downfield. Bridgewater on paper doesn't really look like an Arians quarterback, but maybe they would make adjustments for him. Okay, takeaway number three. This draft at quarterback is Joe Burrow and everyone else. And it really kind of came to life for me when I was in Indianapolis. There are some people that like Tua's tape as much as they like Burrow's tape. But the majority of people I talked to said this is Joe Burrow and everyone else. Joe Burrow absolutely crushed his interviews. He was confident. He was accountable to his mistakes, the few that there were. He showed great knowledge of the LSU offense. And so he's firmly cemented himself in the number one spot. I know the Bengals owner, Mike Brown, likes Justin Herbert. I think the rest of the building right now would be of a mind to draft Joe Burrow. Now, the question, of course, becomes, does Joe Burrow want to be there? And I can give you guys a couple of nuggets on that one. Number one, the Bengals have an incredible resource on hand. They have a third-year, he's going to be a third-year defensive end named Sam Hubbard. Who is that? Well, Sam Hubbard went to Ohio State in 2015, in 2016, in 2017. So for 3 years, he was a teammate of Joe Burrow's. Not only was he a teammate of Joe Burrow's, he's also a roommate of Joe Burrow's. The Bengals have a good idea of where Joe Burrow's head's at right now because Sam Hubbard is a resource for them, has been a resource for them, okay? And so I think they feel pretty decent about where they stand on Burrow right now. The second piece of this, the second nugget I'm going to give you. Joe Burrow's actually, in some of his meetings with other teams, has asked about the Bengals organization. And so he's gathering intelligence on the way the Bengals work, the pluses and minuses of going there. And so Joe Burrow's doing all of his homework, too. I wouldn't set anything in stone right now, but I would tell you, I think Joe Burrow is the number one guy for the Bengals coaching staff, is the number one guy for the Bengals scouting staff. And I do think that when we get to the end of April, Joe Burrow will be a Cincinnati Bengal. Again, nothing set in stone. You know, maybe Joe Burrow decides to go the other way. But right now, for all the flaws there, and he's going to learn about all of them, Joe Burrow is not going to be shielded from these. He has people around him that are going to give him the real story on what's on the way the Bengals work. At the end of all of this, I think he winds up being the number one overall pick and goes to the Cincinnati Bengals, which brings us to takeaway number four, the Redskins' plans. The Redskins have the second overall pick. The Redskins made waves this week when I can't remember if it was Kyle Smith or Ron Rivera. One of them said that they would be looking at all of the top quarterbacks. And I can just tell you right now what's happening there. Number one, they really like Chase Young. And if you look at what's happened with Chase Young over the course of the last 4 or 5 months, he's pretty consistently been the number one player in the draft class. And we knew that only a quarterback was going to be able to pass him. And we knew it was going to, to some degree, come down to whether or not a quarterback needy team was picking first overall. A quarterback got hot. That was Joe Burrow. A quarterback needy team's drafting first overall, that does not mean that Chase Young is not the best player in the draft. I think the Redskins believe Chase Young is the best player in the draft. And you look at the way they're set up, it's not unlike the Niners last year when Chase Young's old teammate was inserted into a defensive line group that had a handful of former first-round picks, Dee Ford, Solomon Thomas, DeForest Buckner, Eric Armstead. Well, Chase Young would be entering into the same situation in Washington where he'd be joining former first-round picks Ryan Kerrigan, Montez Sweat, Daron Payne, and Jonathan Allen. And so I think that, again, chances are Chase Young winds up being a Washington Redskin. However, it would make no sense for them to stick their foot in the ground and say, we are Chase Young's team right now. And the reason why, you need to figure out what you're going to be able to get for the pick, and you need to figure out what you're passing on, okay? If you feel like whoever's out there, okay, is a market improvement over what you have at the quarterback position, which is Dwayne Haskins, then you have to think about taking him. All right, so going through that, and I don't know that they'll get there because the new staff does like Haskins, but I'm just laying that out. Like, you have to figure out what you're passing on if you decide we're going to go with Chase Young. Okay, so that's the first part of it. Number two, they got to figure out what the pick's worth. they got to see whether or not they can get a haul for that pick. And so are they, if somebody comes in and says 3 first-round picks, 4 first-round picks, well, the best way to draw those teams out is to make them believe that a quarterback is in play at number two. And so for those two reasons, it would almost not make sense not to kick the tires on all the quarterbacks, especially when you got a new coaching staff coming in that has no experience with Haskins. And so for those two reasons, again, number one, knowing what you're passing on. Number two, ascertain the value of the pick. It makes sense for the Redskins to do what they're doing, which is kicking tires on all the quarterbacks. And there's a third element here, and that's the side benefit that maybe you light a little fire under Dwayne Haskins by doing this. All right, takeaway number five, the draft class to me is crystallizing. And I'll tell you at the top, the way I see it right now, after Combine, we have 4 elite defensive players in this year's class. Chase Young, who we just talked about, is one. His teammate Jeff Okuda, the corner from Ohio State, is two. We have a defensive tackle from Auburn, Derek Brown, is three. And the wildly athletic jack-of-all-trades linebacker from Clemson, Isaiah Simmons, is number four. Not in that order. Young, I think, is the number one player. The other three, I think, it sort of depends on who you talk to. I over the last couple of weeks, I got a lot of love for Brown, or heard a lot. I've heard a lot of love for Brown. There were points during the draft cycle, this draft cycle, that I've heard Brown put on Young's tier. Not that he's as good as Young, but that those two guys are the top two, and then you have a little bit of a drop-off. But I'd say right now, the way most people look at it, you've got 4 elite defensive players, Young, Okuda, Brown, and Simmons, and then you have 4 offensive tackles who have really sort of separated themselves, and that's a position that's a need in a lot of places in the NFL. You got Andrew Thomas from Georgia, you got Mekhi Becton from Louisville, you got Tristan Wirfs from Iowa, and Jedrick Wills from Alabama. So I think I would say it's almost a sure thing all 4 of the defensive players go in the top 10. I think it's not completely impossible that all 4 of the offensive tackles go in the top 10. And then you'd have Burrow and probably Tua. So there's a decent chance now that, 7 weeks out, we have an idea who the top 10 are going to be. The 4 elite defensive players, the 4 elite offensive tackles, and then the 2 quarterbacks. All right. Without any further hesitation, we're going to get to our special guest right now. All right, we're going to bring back in an old friend of mine and a guy I did television with in Boston over the course of the 2019 season. You know him from his time with the Patriots, his time with the Chiefs. Former NFL quarterback for what, 14 years, I think, Matt? Is that right?
That's correct, 14 years.
All right, that's Matt Cassel. And we're bringing him in because this monster right now, the Brady thing has turned into a monster. It's a feeding frenzy. All the information that's been out there kind of floating around over the course of the last few weeks, every single piece of it gets digested, analyzed, spit back out. And so I thought it'd be smart to bring in somebody who played with Brady, who knows Brady, who played the position, who knows the position, who played for the Patriots, who knows the Patriots. And Matt, I'm going to start here because I think that this is sort of the important part of it. And I'm not asking you to crawl inside Tom Brady's head because he's in a unique situation because he's been in the league for so long. And his status is different, but as a free agent right now, 2 weeks out, what's going through your head when you know your contract's up and you know there are going to be teams that are going to be interested in you, but you really don't have an idea of maybe a full idea of where you're going to play next year?
Right. There's a lot that goes through your mind as a player during this time period. And it's an exciting time period, especially because there might be new opportunities down the road. Sometimes when you become a free agent, it's one of those situations that you're looking for a new start. In Tom's case, so to speak, it's a little bit different because obviously the Patriots are still in play. He becomes a free agent and it's ultimately his decision. So he's in the driver's seat in this situation. And then as you're leading up to free agency, you kind of it starts to formulate, right? You start to have an idea of what teams are interested, what the landscape and the personnel for that organization looks like offensively. And as free agents really starts and it actually kicks in, that's when real conversations take place. But leading up to this, obviously your agent is giving you a broad perspective on what teams really have interest. And then you as a player have to take that calculated thought process and understand, okay, what's going to be best for me as a player. And I know sometimes for free agents, it's money. Other times it's personnel and where can I go to be the most successful right now. And looking at Tom's situation, you have to say for him at his age, he's not going to go somewhere for money, so to speak. I don't think it's a financially motivated decision, rather than where can I go to be the most successful and prove to everybody that I can still play and play at a high level, because that's what ultimately he wants to do, to be successful.
Do you, like, the information that you get 2 or 3 weeks out, because that's where we are right now, right? Would it be accurate? Like, you know, your agent's talking to you, you're hearing what's out there and everything else. Like, was it pretty accurate what you were hearing a couple of weeks before you hit the market?
It's usually very accurate, to be honest with you, especially after the combine. A lot of these discussions that take place between the agents, the organization, the coaching staff take place at the combine. So you start to, it really starts to unfold and you start to pinpoint the, you know, in some cases it's 2 teams, some cases it's 4 to 5 teams that really have interest in you as a player. And those discussions start, and then the conversations that take place between you as a player and your agent, you're trusting the fact that the agent's going to tell you the information that's going on. And now you start to, it kind of starts to come into play and a clear understanding for what's out there and what your opportunities might be.
Did you actually put together a list of like what's important to you? Like, was there actually like prioritizing, okay, money is here, offensive systems here, teammates are here, coaches, like, do you actually put together a list of like what's important to you?
Absolutely. You put together pros and cons. That's a great question. For me as a family man, also, it was, where am I living? Right. And where can I go to give my family a great experience, great neighborhood? Then you start looking at all the things, not just financially speaking and football and organization. Those are obviously at the top of the priority list. But at the same time, where are you going to live? How is that going to work? Are you going to commute? You know, all those things that come in real life situation of, am I going to fly back and forth? Are you going to come with me? Are we going to, pick up, start over in a new city? So there's a lot of things that come into play, especially for older players like Tom, like myself, in some situations where there's more than just football to it.
Did you bring your family with you wherever you went? I think you did, right?
I did, everywhere I went. And that was some of the challenging parts was, you know, you've got to find schools. You've got to find a place to live. You've got to move all your stuff from wherever you were to there, at least temporarily, until you went back to home base. So there's a lot of complicated issues, real life issues that go along with it that can add to the stress of an off season. There's no doubt about it.
What do you think's important to Tom? You know him pretty well. Like, so, like, if you had to guess what are the things that be at the top of his list, what do you think would be at the top of his list?
Well, I think he's not planning to go anywhere and just be mediocre. That doesn't make any sense. If he was to leave New England, there's got to be a great pull for him, especially in terms of personnel with wide receivers, a number one wide receiver, a number two, you know, a skill group around him that can make him better, especially at this point in his career, and somebody that's going to be able to compete for a title. Otherwise, why do you leave New England, who year in, year out is in the playoffs and giving you an opportunity to go play for the ultimate prize at the Super Bowl? There's no reason to leave New England unless you're going to another team that's going to be competitive and give you an opportunity to go to the Super Bowl. So to me, that's number one.
Okay, what would be number two then? It looked like you were going on to number two there.
Yeah, no, I don't. You know what? That's got to be the main decision for him is, do you go to a different division? Look, if you look at the division with the New England Patriots, right? You got the Buffalo Bills right now, who are the second closest team that's going to be competitive against New England. Other than that, Miami and the Jets. It's a great division to be in, right? You look at a team, people have talked about the Chargers. Well, the Chargers, there's no guarantees there. You start with the Chiefs, right? The Super Bowl defending champions. The Raiders are pretty good. You go with people throwing out the Bucks. Well, you're in the division with New Orleans, Atlanta, Carolina. So, and then Miami, I mean, people throw out the Miami at times, and you're saying, well, you're in the division with the Patriots and now the Buffalo Bills that are playing better. So I don't think he's going somewhere to lose and just have it just to play to play. He's going somewhere to win, and wherever he picks the season, it's got to be a place that's going to be a Super Bowl contender.
Okay, so I've had people in New England tell me that it'll be almost impossible to recreate what he has there because there's so much institutional knowledge in that building between Bill and Josh and how he plays, his strengths, his weaknesses. And that offense is really, I guess, like bastardized in a good way, right? Like where it's become so much about him over the years because it's just form fitted to him almost at this point. Do you agree with that? Do you think it would be almost impossible to create what he has in New England from a system standpoint?
I do agree with that statement. I think when you're in a system for 20 some odd years and you've helped formulate a lot of the offensive structure and you've been in it and you understand the little nuances, the ins and outs, the protection calls, and none of that has changed for 20 years of your career, and you have a coordinator that's familiar with your strengths, familiar with your weaknesses, familiar with what routes you like, what routes you throw well, there's so much advantage to that. And when you go to a new system, even if it's a similar system, there's a lot of change that takes place. And coaches use different vernacular, different verbiage for how to describe different fronts even. And also, how much give and take will there be when he goes into a new system that they're saying, hey, we want to recreate what you had in New England. That adds not only pressure, but a huge time commitment by Tom to help set up that infrastructure and set up that system and work with that coach. And so there's a lot more time on pass and a lot more required out of him as a quarterback versus showing up, trusting the people that you're working with and doing it like he's done for so long in New England, instead of going to a new system, now building that trust. And also how much give and take is there going to be? Because I use the example like the Tennessee Titans with Arthur Smith, who's a completely different system in terms of how they call their terminology. Well, does now Mike Vrabel, after 2 years of being in the system and having the success that they did last year, go in and say, we want to bring Tom in, but now, guys, we're starting all over. That means from A.J. Brown to Tajay Sharp to Corey Davis to Johnny Smith, that all these guys have to learn a new offensive system, and can they get caught up to speed? It's like starting over. You know what I mean? So there's a lot that goes into that decision.
How hard is it to play in the Patriots system? Like, I've always felt like, you know, we've seen good skill players go there and it doesn't work because maybe they're not doing it exactly the way Tom wants it done, right? Like, I feel like we've seen like good pros go there, guys who've been in the league, and it just for one reason or another, it doesn't fit them. How hard is it? How hard would it be for, you know, again, like you bring up the Titans, like an A.J. Brown who's going to be in his second year in the league, a Jonnu Smith, who I believe will be in year four. You know, like how hard would it be for guys like that to adjust to what Tom Brady needs to be successful as a quarterback?
Well, it all starts with the accountability factor and the system itself. It takes time. I mean, I went through it for 4 years, and it really wasn't until my, you know, getting into through my second year and going through that second preseason and actually being able to run the concepts. The system itself takes time to learn how they call formations. It's a zero out slot, zero on, which for other teams, it's like double right, dual right, deuce right. You know what I mean? It may be a little bit easier in terms of formation, but at the same time, they put a lot on you with adjustments and empty formations and moving you around to get the best matchup. So they try to take all the advantage that they can out of creating opportunities for players against matchup issues and stuff like that. At the same time, it puts a lot of responsibility on that player to learn and grind and work. And Josh McDaniels, Bill Belichick, and Tom Brady, the environment that they create, they put a lot on players, and a lot of players, you know, can't handle that pressure when they get there and they can't get caught up to speed. And that becomes an issue.
Is it possible? I mean, like, is it possible that he goes to the Chargers or the Raiders or the Titans or the Bucks, and you know, whether it's, you know, Mike Evans and Chris Godwin in Tampa, or Mike Williams and Keenan Allen in, you know, in LA, or you know, Tyrell Williams and Darren Waller and all those guys in Vegas, or like you said, AJ Brown, Jonnu Smith, you know, Corey Davis and all those guys in Nashville. Is it possible to take what you've built in New England, what you've been in New England for 20 years, and in a single offseason kind of help a coordinator who doesn't have experience with what you've done recreate it in a new place?
I think it's possible. However, it's unlikely that you get to where you're at after 20 seasons with the same system and the same coordinator with a brand new coordinator. Now, you can absolutely, everybody has similar concepts and everybody has the pop pass, and everybody has your play action, and everybody has your quick game with the, whether it's a slant with a diagonal on the outside or two slants on the weak side. So everybody has concepts that are similar. However, it's how you call that play. And also for a quarterback, I've been through it a lot. I had 12 coordinators, I think, in 14 years, different offensive coordinators, and everybody was a little bit different. And so it's also time on task. If you change that verbiage and how they call it in the terminology, it's, does that make sense in your mind as a quarterback? Right now, it's everything second nature to him. When you go into a new system and you start making adjustments, is it still second nature? Because I know it took me time every time I went into a new system with new terminology. It took me time to conceptualize it in my brain, see it, instead of just going out and going, got it. As soon as that call is made, I understand it in my head. I know what I want to do versus post safety defense. I know what I want to do versus split safety. If they give me some oddball, this, that, or the other, I know my get out of jail free card is right here on my check down. And when you're in a system like that and you can operate like that, you play at a high level. When you start to slow it down, you're thinking a little bit about, gosh, is this what he called? And can I conceptualize that quickly? Call it in the play, get to the line of scrimmage, make my adjustments with the different protection calls and go. It's a little bit different when it just takes you a little bit more time to get caught up to speed.
Is there any way to meet in the middle? You hear that a lot. Like, and I think to some degree, Peyton did that a little bit in Denver where, right, they had some tenets of what Mike McCoy's system then was similar to what you guys ran. Like, so there was some of that, but like then it was mostly Peyton's system. Is there a way to meet in the middle? Like, is there a way to kind of, if you're Tennessee or you're Vegas or you're the Chargers, is there a way to accommodate both? You know what I mean? Where you can say, okay, like, we're going to do this for Tom, but we also want to keep these things in place for everyone else.
Right. And I think that the Peyton example is a great illustration of that, is where they did meet in the middle and they were able to have success. And Peyton, at the same time, was able to put his fingerprint on it and was able to create what he needed to have in the offensive structure, whether it was the no huddle package and how he had created that and moved forward and fit that into the system and made it a little bit of his own and had ownership in it. At the same time, not changing everything so drastically that everybody else is out of whack and you have to start over from scratch.
Okay. Before I let you go, there's another guy who's involved in this who you also know really well, and that's Mike Vrabel, who not only did you play with him the first 4 years of your career in New England, you were actually traded with him to Kansas City, right? Played another couple right. years with him in Kansas City. Do you think there's a part of Mike that would like to be the guy who was able to pull Tom out of New England?
You know what? That's a good question. And when you look at it like that, I mean, Mike's a prideful guy to say the least. And there could be part of that. At the same time, he's building something here in Tennessee. And he started in Arthur Smith. And what they did this year was remarkable, to say the least, after the start that he had. And to make a commitment to Tom, especially a guy that he's so familiar with. And he's not only familiar with him, but he's a really good friend of his off the field, the annual trips to the Derby and all that. Being that close to somebody, I don't know if that's exactly what Mike's looking for at this point in his young coaching career. And especially with Arthur Smith, like I said, he has a different terminology and different way in which he calls the offensive scheme. To start over from, instead of building off of what they did last year, to start all the way over with Tom Brady, who you're only going to have for maybe another year, possibly two. I mean, if we're talking about 45, maybe 3 years. So if it works out and where they go win Super Bowls, great. But it's, I think, high risk, high reward situation for him.
That's interesting. So you think like the close relationship could actually be seen as a negative by Mike?
I just think that there's so much comfort between the two, and at times, what he's built there and how the players look at him versus Tom, who's so familiar with him and has a different relationship and his outlook on Vrabel. I think that might, have Vrabel a little bit more uncomfortable than it would be comfortable with the situation.
Okay, so you're part of the Derby crew too. You've known Tom for 15 years now. I'm not going to hold you to this, but I want your opinion because you've got a really good feel for this guy and what he thinks is important and probably how he looks at the league, because you've been in those meeting rooms with him on March 20th, March 21st, whatever it is. Where's Tom Brady?
I think he's, I truly believe he's going to re-sign with the Patriots somehow, some way they get it done. And he goes back and they start rocking and rolling again.
How do you think Bill handles it?
The way he's always handled it. He's business as usual. And he knows he's got his quarterback, and he also knows that he's in a better situation than he would be without him. You got to take into consideration he wants to win championships as well. And I know that there might be a power struggle here or there. At the same time, if they are able to re-sign Brady, I think it alleviates a lot more issues than what he would have if you start all over with a Jared Stidham, or you go out and you have to draft somebody, or you go out in free agency, bring in a bridge guy like Andy Dalton. There's a lot more to your offseason structure and what goes into it and winning ball games than when you say the guy that's been a staple here for 20 years comes back, and now we have to figure out the pieces of the puzzle around him, get him help, the supporting cast that he needs to be successful. Because, Bill Belichick's the greatest coach ever to coach the game, and he knows that they were inadequate on offense last year from a personnel standpoint. And I think he takes great pride in that, of going out and restructuring that offensive scheme with the right personnel to go out and be successful this year offensively.
But he probably doesn't get warm and fuzzy, right? Like, he probably doesn't cozy up to, like, he probably like handles this like he handles most other player situations, right? Where he kind of coldly lays out the situation for the player, and it's sort of a take it or leave it type of thing, right?
Right. And that's the beauty of Bill Belichick, and that's why he's been able to move forward away from players. And there's not that personal relationship that he has. Now, he's got much more of a personal relationship with Tom Brady than probably anybody else he's ever had throughout the years. However, there's also that disconnect. There's a clear line that says, I'm the coach and you're the player. And it's a transaction that'll take place. He's not going to call you and be like, I'm so happy you're here. This is amazing. You're coming back. We're going to do great things this year. It's just going to be like, Tom, I'm so happy we could work it out. And, you know, I'm glad. Let's go win another championship. And that's probably the extent of what it's going to be. And then business as usual.
It's funny you say that, because I've always heard from guys who play for him that, like, it's almost like he flips a switch. When you're not playing for him anymore, he's great. Like, that's what I've heard from so many different people.
Right. Even when I left New England, he'd call me and leave me messages at time. And when I saw him out in Hawaii, or when I see him around town and this, that, and the other, he was always unbelievable. Would come up, talk to you, check in on you, check on your family. So I just think it's his general approach to coaching, and how he doesn't have any blurred lines. And so in that way, he can move on from players if need be, to make if he thinks that the team can get better at certain positions without holding on to a player, maybe after he's missed those years and he's not in his prime anymore.
Did you get the congrats text like Jimmy did? Remember that whole thing?
The what?
The congrats text. You know how Jimmy apparently got like the congrats text after wins. Did you get any of those from Bill?
You know what? I got a few texts throughout my first year in Kansas City, and Bill's always been great to me, especially, I mean, throughout giving me the opportunity and everything else. But at the same time, even once I left, and every time I saw him, he has always been one of my biggest fans in terms of how much of a big fan he is for people that leave his organization. Every time I talk to him, he's been amazing. I've always got a great feedback from him.
Okay, Matt. So this is normally where I tell people where they can find my guest on social media, but I'm not so sure that that's going to work for you, right?
That's exactly right. I'm going to get a Twitter account one of these days, I promise you, or a Instagram or something that will allow me to follow me on this.
Awesome. All right. He's Matt Cassel, former Patriots quarterback, former Chiefs quarterback. You can catch him with me on NBC Sports Boston next season. I hope that'll
let's do it, brother.
I hope that all works out. Appreciate you coming out, Matt.
Absolutely, bro. Talk to you soon, buddy.
All right, always appreciate Matt coming out. He's the best, good friend of mine. Very, very knowledgeable about his stuff. Trust me, I sat next to him every week during the season, saw the notes he takes, saw the things he notices. He's very, very good at this stuff. We're going to jump right into the mailbag. You guys know how this works. Every week I put the call out for questions. Two ways you can get to us. You can either email us at BreerMailbag@gmail.com. That's my last name, mailbag, all one word, @gmail.com. Or, and we sort of prefer you doing this, we can hear your voice. You can call and leave us a voicemail at 201-596-4346. Again, email us at BreerMailbag@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 201-596-4346. As we always do, we're going to bring in our executive producer, Shelby Royston. Now, Shelby, question number one.
From Charles, what is the likelihood that Dak Prescott skips any and all offseason and voluntary workouts if he is franchise tagged to avoid any type of injury?
I do not think that he will sit out the spring. I do not think he will sit out the summer. I think when he gets his tender, which will come in, and it's going to be the exclusive tag at about $33 million, I do believe he's going to sign it. He doesn't want any sort of risk involved with losing that money. That's the thing, is that they can remove the tag if he hasn't signed it. And you don't want to give the Cowboys any chance to pull it off of you and go and make a run at Tom Brady, go and make a run at Phillip Rivers, whatever it is. You don't want that threat out there. And I know, despite how, like, and that's the threat would be so small, but you don't even want to create that sort of uncertainty. So you sign the tender, it's $33 million in your pocket for a guy who was a fourth-round pick, and then you continue to negotiate because your leverage is the Cowboys won't want that lump sum sitting on their salary cap, and the Cowboys will not want to be in a situation where they have to tag him again, in which case it would cost the team, I believe, around $40 million in 2021. So you've created some motivation for them to get a deal done. And because you're the quarterback, it's important that you're there. It's not the same as guys at other positions. And so I would say there's a very good chance that he'll be there for the beginning of the offseason program with a signed tender, but negotiations ongoing towards a long-term deal. Shelby, question number two.
From Zach, with the Ravens' need for pass rushers, what do you think they're most likely to do to address their pass rush? I know there's been a lot of talk of keeping Judon, but even with keeping him, they still have a need.
It's a good question, and I think there's a chance they trade Judon. You know, I think they're going to look at the idea of that. Really, if you look at their situation, Judon's a free agent. Pernell McPhee is a free agent. They have some younger guys in the pipeline that they really like. And so, you know, Jalen Ferguson, Tyus Bowser, those are guys that they drafted fairly high that they believe can become really good players. And so, you know, it's going to have to sort of be the same thing that has been at those positions over the course of the last few years. I mean, you may remember Pernell McPhee went to the Bears a few years ago, and Judon was one of the guys that replaced him. They've been able to sort of cycle guys through those spots over the years, and I think you sort of trust your process there. And so if you have to go forward with Judon on the franchise tag for 1 year, you do it. If somebody blows you away with an offer, you use the draft capital to turn around and try to replace them. And you have faith in what you've built there and being able to develop young pass rushers and going and bringing back Jalen Ferguson and Tyus Bowser and hoping that you get a better version of those two guys. Shelby, question number three.
We have a voicemail from Matt.
Hey, Albert, it's Matt. Just curious, with Tony Romo's new deal now confirmed with CBS, what do you expect ESPN to do with their Monday Night Broadcast team? Is Peyton Manning part of that? Thanks.
Well, thank you, Matt. That's more Jimmy Trina's department at our place than it is mine. So, you know, I can't tell you exactly what ESPN's going to do. Of course, there are some names out there. I don't know what Troy Aikman's contract situation is, but if they made a run at Romo, I guess it would make sense to make a run at Troy Aikman, maybe make a run at Chris Collinsworth. You know, I think that there's, you know, clearly they want a big name in that spot. And so, you know, if they couldn't land the hottest name, which is Romo, then maybe they go to one of the others. Again, that sort of all depends on contract situations and everything else. As for the impact of it, I can speak to that. I think it sort of illustrates why the NFL believes that the time to do a new set of television deals is right now. the reason why ABC and ESPN and Disney went after Romo the way that they did is because they have a strong desire to get back in the Super Bowl rotation, and perhaps there's a desire from the league to put the Monday Night Football back on ABC, which would change its profile, which would probably enhance the lineup of games it gets. And so the ABC people want, the ABC, ESPN, Disney people, you know, if you want a better chance at getting a bigger platform, having a bigger platform, having, you know, better games on Monday night, having the Super Bowl, then it behooves you to put together the best team that you possibly can to call the games. And so that's where Romo's name came in. That's where, you know, I think you could see some other big names. Peyton Manning's name's been floating around out there. And I think it just underscores where you look at the high stakes game that's going on between the networks now, where the networks are eager to start bidding on the broadcast packages. And that eagerness was illustrated by the amount of money that CBS was willing to pay to get Tony Romo, and the amount of money that ABC, ESPN, Disney was willing to give up to try and poach him. Shelby, question number four.
From Brandon, under the proposed CBA, how will personal conduct policy issues be reviewed? Will the commissioner still be the judge, jury, and executioner for any incidents?
Okay, so I, like, with limited knowledge of how our judicial system works, I would say he will no longer be the, I don't know how this worked, judge. He'd no longer be the judge, but he will be the jury, because maybe you would have a bench trial and then a jury trial, I guess. I don't know how all that works. What I would tell you is, under the new system, it will go to an independent arbitrator. Personal conduct policy issues will go to an independent arbitrator, and then the appeals process will go to Commissioner Goodell. Now, I know some people have said that because Roger's in that spot, it basically, in effect, doesn't change anything. Well, that's not really true. I think if, you know, an independent arbitrator is willing to clear a player, it makes it that much more difficult for Roger to convict a player. And so I think it does materially change that. Now, the commissioner maintains power over that, which they've been very adamant. That's historically been the way it is. But I do think that one is a win for the players, because it's been very, very difficult over the years to get the commissioner to give up that power. That said, the commissioner will still be in charge of, you know, on-field integrity type issues when it comes to players being accused of A, B, or C. Shelby, question number five.
From Mark. With more teams relying on the tight end position to help with receiving options, do you see teams planning on increasing that position's salary scale? Superstar players like Kelce and Kittle seem to be limited with what they can earn based on the current salary structure.
Yeah, it's hard. It's going to be hard for that to happen, because what will need to happen is you'll need to have some sort of catalyst for that, and that means a guy getting to the end of his deal. Sometimes that might mean a guy playing through his playing through his franchise tag season. The way it happened at receiver, if you want to go back and look at it historically, both Larry Fitzgerald and Calvin Johnson were top five picks in the old system. And so their contracts had huge back end numbers on them, which drove up their leverage, drove up their franchise tag numbers, and ultimately allowed them to change the market, their position. And so now you see the top receivers, Michael Thomas making almost 20, Julio Jones making 22, Odell Beckham making 18 million, even Sammy Watkins making 16 million. And, you know, we'll see what Amari Cooper, what AJ Green, what those guys get. But historically, the reason why the paradigm changed at receiver and the market went through the roof is because you had guys being drafted that high in the old system. We haven't had that at the tight end position, so the value of tight ends has stagnated. All this is driven by the franchise tag. And so it's going to take somebody like George Kittle sitting there and saying, I'm willing to play through this year. I'm willing to play through next year. I'm willing to force my way to the market if I need to. Otherwise, the gains are going to be incremental. And the crazy thing about it is, in a lot of ways you could argue a great tight end, and there aren't that many of them, is more valuable than a great receiver. But just because of the mechanics of it, because of the way that it's worked, it's evolved that way, where the best receivers in the game are actually making twice as much as the best tight ends in the game. It will take, again, a catalyst. Somebody needs to to hold the line, be willing to take on the injury risk to play through things and make their way there. And I mean, look, like if you're George Kittle and you're being offered, say, $30 million guaranteed and you were a fifth round pick, it's really, really hard to say, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to take on all that injury risk. Shelby, question number five.
From Wes, what's the likelihood the competition committee approves a sky judge for the 2020 season?
Well, Wes, I think, I mean, it sounds like the pass interference review system is in trouble. I can tell you that the coaches that met last year in Arizona, was it? I believe it was Arizona. Wherever it was, the owners' meeting last year, I believe it was in Arizona. The coaches' meeting last year in Arizona really thought that getting pass interference reviews into the pipeline would be a step towards the sky judge. And I know some are concerned that if you take away the pass interference review system, you're one step backwards. You're a little further away from getting the sky judge. But I will say this. There are members of the competition committee that were very aware during the season that the NFL were very aware that coaches still want the sky judge. In fact, there was an instance during the season, and most of the coaches know about this now, where a sky judge was actually implemented. You guys may remember Earl Thomas's hit on Mason Rudolph. If you go back and you look at the broadcast of that game, they went to commercial. There was no flag on the ground. They came back from commercial. There was a flag on the ground. Ravens coaches asked about that. What the officials told them was the guy upstairs in the booth was the one who buzzed down and told them to drop the flag. That's sky judge, right? So it seems like it actually did work in that circumstance, and it could work going forward. I'm for the sky judge. I know the coaches are for the sky judge. Eagles owner Jeffrey Lurie may be the key here. You look at Jeffrey Lurie's history over the last year. In March, he was in full support of the coaches and their efforts to try to make sure we get a system in there where we get it right more often than not. So that's number one. And then again, coming back in December at the league's winter meeting, Lurie actually advocated changing the paradigm completely, looking inside out, looking at everything when it comes to officiating and trying to determine what they're doing right, what they're doing wrong, not working on any preconceived notions, just starting from scratch and building a new officiating system. So that's something that I think will also be discussed when the league gets together in March, later in March, at their meetings in Palm Beach. And again, I think it's going to be the coaches pushing for more review and a bit more efficient review system. And I do think there are some owners that are of a mind to listen to it. It'll be interesting to see if we see that whole sort of overhaul seriously discussed. Shelby, question number six.
From Matthew, there's a lot of talk about what Belichick expects for Brady to return to the Pats, but don't you think this is more about Robert Kraft himself getting the deal done with Brady? When the Pats sent Jimmy G to the 49ers, that's not something Belichick would have wanted, so it seems like this will come down to Kraft and Brady making it happen.
All right, Matthew is his name, right?
Yes.
All right, Matthew, we discussed this a little off the top. I tell you, my understanding is Robert Kraft has committed to not interfering on this, and I think it makes sense if you really want to examine the reason why. The reason why, in his mind, is because interfering would do no good, wouldn't do any good for anybody. It would be, God, that was bad English. It would poison the relationship between Brady and Belichick because Brady would probably know that Kraft stepped in and that Belichick didn't want him at the price that he'd be coming back at. It would poison the relationship between Belichick and Kraft. You'd be creating a toxic situation in your building. You'd be inviting a toxic situation into your building. And so for that reason, I do not think that Kraft is going to touch this one unless he is called upon. Now, if he's needed as a resource, if they need to be creative cap-wise, if they need to be creative financially, whatever they need to do, he'll be there for that. And I think he'd be more than happy to help facilitate the process of getting Brady back in a Patriots uniform, but he will not be driving that process. Shelby, we got a seventh question, or is that it?
That's it.
All right. Appreciate it, Shelby. Appreciate all you guys, too, coming out always. You guys know where to get me. You can get me all of your feedback. We will implement that feedback if it's good. On all my social channels, on Twitter at Albert Breer, on Facebook at Albert R. Breer, on Instagram at Albert_Breer. And remember to listen to all of our podcasts. Under one feed now, you can get the Weekside podcast featuring Jenny and Connor. You can get the Monday Morning Podcast, which has had a rotation of guests. And you get this podcast, of course, the MMQB Podcast with Albert Breer. We do three shows a week now, five shows a week during the season. But all of us are under that one heading now, the MMQB NFL Podcast. And if you're getting out of work and you haven't been caught up on NFL news and you need to be caught up on NFL news, we got a podcast for you there too. That's the MMQB News Podcast. That drops every day. Again, the MMQB NFL Podcast, the MMQB News Podcast. Follow those two feeds. You can get them on Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, wherever you guys get your shows. Same time next week. I'll see you guys then.